Give it all. Yeah. The mighty lions from Zion ignite the flame of what I am. Tossing fire, leaving Babylon crying, trying to escape this futile. Who child is time to jungle is too wild. That's why we got more than two stars. Two adept in the situation, who child. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try. The next mile to break sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this time to wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven's fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom with all thy getting. Get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. /timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And then that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening. Whether you're programmed with the live stream on the TuneIn app, drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being posted in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by both professors on the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:10 here in the city of Philadelphia on May 3rd in this shelter in place mode that we're in, and we're going to have an interesting conversation tonight with our communities being hit hard statistically by this COVID-19 virus. Should there be a demand among Black people to their quote-unquote leadership to adopt a public health policy to aid our communities directly? We'll be talking about this with our special guest. And he's been a guest on this program many times before, activist, journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. He's also a current activist and always been activist in both Cuba and Venezuela. Brother Obi Egbona Jr. be with us today to talk about this issue and a lot of information that you might not know about. It's always good to have Brother Obi back with us, and we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Now, usually, Ellie, you know, the Richard Weather Report. But how can you give a weather report if you got to be locked down inside? I hear the numbers, and then I'm saying, like, I can't even go out and see the sun. They're getting serious about this, ain't they?
You go out, just wear your mask.
But I'm doing fine and looking forward to our discussion with Brother Obi, because you know, we've been dealing with this whole thing of just the whole, I think, two various ideals as far as Africans in North America being operating like a colony, and the other thing that is being exposed out of this pandemic that they're projecting, and the COVID-19 virus that is affecting so many of the people in the African-American community, of whether we, as you say, not just holding account political representatives accountable for coming up with a public health policy, but we need to be, as African-Americans in our communities, be considering and working out what is a public health policy that we agree on, and what is a public health structure that we need within our community, because this virus or not, and the amount of deaths this virus is taking or not, we've been losing people because of our public health, and it's being being demonstrated in this virus. And I think Brother Obi can help us, teed out from other examples and other models, other places, what might be a good policy and structure.
You know, Richard, I think this is a excellent topic and a great person to have talk about this because of his activism on various continents and in various nations on all fronts. You know, we talk on this program and we have guests on, historians, activists, and other people to talk about sovereignty and independence for our people. And if we're serious about those things, we need to become more proactive in developing strategies to move our people forward. Mm-hmm. This thing that has happened here, you can't help from becoming reactive to it because it caught people unaware. But this can be a lesson for us to develop strategies and keep developing strategies independent of this country that directly deals with the needs of our people and to move our people forward. I spoke with Brother Obi a little over a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, and he talked about a petition that was being circulated, spearheaded by himself and a few others. I'm going to give him the credit because he's the one I talked to. In reference to the Cuban doctors getting involved directly with our community and the country in general would benefit to aid our people medically in what's going on. A petition was circulated among grassroots organizations. In fact, it spanned the gamut. It's a lot of people involved on that petition, and he's going to talk about that this evening. He can do it justice by talking about all the people involved. But, you know, these things and the subject matter we're going to get into tonight, I think that everybody should get involved in. You'll be hearing it tonight, hearing a lot of information, a lot of it you may or may not be aware of. But the importance of establishing a public health policy for our people is paramount in moving forward. Before we do that, let me pull this. I wanted to pull that information up, but I'll just go right into bringing our guest on. Activist, journalist, playwright, and correspondent to Zimbabwe's national newspaper, The Herald. Brother Obi Bona Jr. is with us, and I think he's on hiatus from the Herald right now. But Brother Obi, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine. I'm, good. Good evening.
What's up, glad, brother?
How are you?
I'm glad to have you back with us always, myself and Brother Richard.
And it's always a pleasure and an honor to be back. It's something that we don't take for granted, and it's nice to know that platforms like this are available when we have something to share.
Yeah, Brother Obi, before I got to kind of do a little historical background on the Cuban doctors, let's kind of talk about the proclamation, the declaration that was circulated by yourself.
Okay.
And then we'll backtrack and then do a little historical background of Cuban doctors. But let's talk about
the problem.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, like I said, I'm so humble, as always, to be on this show. I love the show. I love the energy. I love the drive. I love the spirit. And I love the sincerity. And anything that we can humbly add, it's a pleasure and an obligation to do so. Tonight, in most instances that I've had the been blessed to be on this platform, it's been in two capacities. As Brother Elliot mentioned, the U.S. correspondent to the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, as Zimbabwe is a few weeks removed from its 40th anniversary being an independent and sovereign nation. So that's always great to know. And when I'm not in that capacity, I've been on representing the Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company and the Mass Emphasis Positive Action and Creativity Youth Brigade, both which I have the honor of co-establishing. But tonight, I'm on in a different capacity. I'm wearing another hat. I'm the External Relations Officer of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association. And that's an association that represents the people-to-people solidarity and camaraderie between the masses of Cuba and the masses of Zimbabwe, which is a very special story in itself. How I got appointed to that capacity, though, let's just get the minor thing out the way. In 2003, an African named Cosme Torres Espinoza, who was the deputy ambassador to then the Cuban interest section in Washington, D.C. And it was an interest section at that point because when you don't have normalized relations with a country, you can have an interest section. And it functions the same way an embassy does. People who would like to develop relationships would you approach you. But if you don't have normalized relations, then it's not a full-fledged embassy. And the highest-ranking officer, second highest-ranking officer, in that building at the time was Cosme Torres Espinoza. He was the deputy ambassador. And he was deported from the United States under false charges of espionage. And there was some confusion even within the ranks of the U.S. government because the FBI was saying that they didn't push it. So then the question became who pushed it. So obviously, but the bottom line is he had to leave. And he's of African ancestry. His next post was he happened to be made the Cuban ambassador to Zimbabwe. And my second day there, I went and paid him a surprise visit. And we talked, and he recruited me to the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association. So I was involved in that organization before I even started writing for the Herald. And through consistently working with that organization, 4 years ago, they gave me this responsibility. And in that capacity, a month and a half ago, we embarked on a campaign when we saw the spreading of COVID-19/SARS-CoV-2, which is the most deadly form of the pandemic. And in conjunction with the Organization of African Doctors, which is an organization that the medical students in Cuba of African ancestry started, we came up with a historical appeal. Not a petition, but not an initiative, but an appeal. And the difference is, for listeners who don't know, appeals target organizations, networks, and institutions, and individuals who have a rich background and pedigree in connection to organizations that they have served faithfully and diligently. And so we came up with an appeal. So because it's an appeal, it's in the tradition of David Walker's appeal. It's in the tradition of the appeal that the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey made to the League of Nations in 1923 in connection to genocide. It's in connection to the appeal that Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois made to the United Nations in 1947 that was, and he was viciously attacked by none other than First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who ironically was on the NAACP's board of directors at the time that Dr. Du Bois made that appeal. And of course, in the spirit, the fighting spirit of the appeal that Brother Malcolm, Brother Omawali was working on, trying to take the United States before the United Nations, in that similar energy, with that similar drive, with that similar concentration, with that similar focus. But of course, the NYPD, FBI, and CIA had other ideas. So he never got the opportunity to do that. So when we thought about this, we were focusing on those four initiatives. I mean, those four efforts by those great, great, great fighters. And we did this in loving memory of three cultural icons: the great Cameroonian jazz musician Manu Dibango, who lost his life due to the COVID-19 pandemic; Ellis Marsalis, the father of Wynton Marsalis, Branford Marsalis, Delfeo Marsalis, who also in his 80s transitioned to the ancestors with symptoms people considered in connection to the COVID pandemic; and Bill Withers, the world-renowned composer, writer, and singer, who succumbed to a heart attack and wasn't necessarily attributed to this, but we felt that because we lost such an icon, we could pay him tribute. But it's dedicated to two friends and supporters, lifelong supporters of Cuba, the New York Assemblyman Charles Barron and his wife, Councilwoman Inez Barron, who are both recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic as we speak. Mm-hmm. And so the appeal has four areas of concentration. Number one is urging the White House, the U.S. Congress, and U.S. Senate to grant the Henry Reeves Medical Brigade, Cuba's medical personnel, permission to deploy an emergency brigade to come to U.S. borders and provide hands-on medical assistance in hospitals, clinics, and other emergency installations. We're urging the U.S. government to grant the Henry Reeves Medical Brigade permission to do hands-on training with U.S. medical personnel who are not experienced in dealing with a pandemic of this magnitude. Thirdly, when they are granted permission to be here, they would work in accordance with the National Medical Association, which African people created in 1896 when we were not allowed to join the American Medical Association, the Black Nurses Association, and the American Medical Association, who all three had relationships with Cuba's Ministry of Public Health. And then the fourth thing is for the United States, primarily the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, to grant all victims struggling with the COVID-19 SARS or COVID-2 pandemic, whatever the degree of illness is, access to interferon alpha-2b, which was developed in the 1980s in Cuba's Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology. And that measure would be in step in concert with 45 nations who have already made a formal request for interferon alpha-2b based on its proven effectiveness as a form of treatment. So they were several comrades of ours who distributed this, Brother Elliot being one of them, Bumbo Shishango, retired national co-chair of the National Network in Cuba, Zaki Baludi of the Universal African American People's Organization, Jermaine Shabazz with the Foundation of Black America, Reverend Marjani Dele, right there in Philadelphia, Empress Chi, the founder and president general of the National Million Women's Movement March and Universal Movements, Brother Jordan Geiger out of Indiana, Kwaku Lumumba, who does some work on the ground with Haiti, and the Creole name of his organization is Convit Citoyen Socialis pour Sauver Haiti. Professor Fahima Sek for Media Outreach, Dr. Joan Brown Campbell and Reverend Albert Pennybaker, the former General Secretaries and Assistant Secretary Generals of the National Council of Churches, Tej Griwal for a crucial role she played on the West Coast, and of course, Dr. Lucille Norville Perez, former NMA president, board member, and was the NMA president that led a historical delegation to Cuba. So as Brother Elliot, which we'll get into, when we begin to go over the list of people who supported this appeal, I think that would speak for itself. But he just wanted me to begin by just giving a backdrop about what we're aiming to do. And I hope I was able to cover that.
Yeah. And now what I want to do is kind of backtrack, because I want to, I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here, and I want you to fill in all the areas that need to be filled in. And this is from a published report in Black Agenda in 2017. And I know the numbers have went up since then, but I'll read it from this report in 2017. Under Fidel Castro's direction, Cuba, a medical superpower, now setting new standards for global solidarity in the interest of human health, Cuba's Latin American School of Medicine, ELAM, has been training students from the United States to be doctors since 1999. It has graduated more than 28,500 doctors from 103 countries free of charge. Cuba has graduated 170 doctors from the United States through the project of the Latin American School of Medicine, which is which was initiated by Fidel Castro. David Floyd was a doctor there from went to school there from 2016 and graduated in 2017. Thank the Cuban leadership, the Cuban people, the teachers, the workers, the Noble Project for an example of integration between peoples for the humane world. And talked about his studies there for 7 years leading up to his getting his doctorate. Talk about the Cuban project that have been, now all the while this has been going on, there's been a 50-year blockade against Cuba. But they have been dedicating themselves, according to published reports, and seeing the evidence that they have, graduated, and this is up until 2017, 28,500 doctors in over 103 countries, and 170 of them was from the States. Talk about that in relation to some of the things going on. You mentioned about helping the United States because they're inexperienced in pandemics, but some of the pandemics that have went on in the past 10 years, our listening audience, I think they're aware, if they're not, that the Cuba's doctors have been dispatched worldwide in some of the other pandemics that has happened. So talk about the doctors and things of that nature.
Well, a couple of things. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Well, number one, this is the 20th anniversary of the memorandum of understanding that was signed between the government of Cuba through the Ministry of Public Health and the Congressional Black Caucus. And it stems from a conversation between the late Comandante Fidel Castro and Congressman Benny Thompson out of Mississippi, who, when giving the doctors available to people in Mississippi per capita, Comandante Fidel said those numbers are almost identical to the access that people in Cuba had to doctors prior to our revolution. And he said that it was because of that dynamic they decided to make healthcare and their doctors and their medical personnel, making that one of the cornerstones of the revolutionary process in Cuba. So immediately after that, a memorandum of understanding was officially signed that Cuba was willing to offer 500 scholarships on an annual basis to young people in this country who had aspirations to be involved in medicine. And they would be students of African ancestry, students of Hispanic ancestry, and Native American ancestry. And later on down the line, poor Caucasians, that they became infused into the mix, so to speak. And it was supposed to be 500 a year that were offered. And as you said, not even 200 or 250 have been cleared. But obviously, with that being said, the first 500 were not cleared. And from the very beginning, we worked very hard to get many different people involved in it. Right around that time, though, the Chronicle of Higher Education started talking about the advantage of having health relations with Cuba in the field of education. And this goes back to what I wanted to say about Zimbabwe, which I did. Between 1986 and 1996, 3,000 Zimbabwean teachers went to the Island of Youth in Cuba for academic training. And the fact that Zimbabwe today in 2020 boasted 97% literacy rate, the highest in Africa. That is, there's a direct correlation between that and the training of those teachers in Cuba. So on that end, what was happening was, I think it was Duke, Tulane, Berkeley, and Harvard. They were the first schools to go full-fledged for cultural exchange programs with Cuba. And Bowie State University, I was working there at the time in the dorms, and I had to do different programming on the campus and community outreach programming. So we played a small role in facilitating an agreement that Bowie State University at that time was on the verge of becoming the first historical Black college and university to have a cultural exchange program in Cuba. But after the 2000 elections, and this that stemmed from the fact that some business people, primarily Ted Turner and the leadership of General Electric, had talked to the Clinton administration about the advantages economically at the corporate level of normalizing business relations with Cuba. And right after that, before Clinton exited the White House, the Pentagon had removed Cuba from the national security threat list. And you began to see overtures of that sort. And of course, the situation with Ilian Gonzalez factors in here as well. But the Bush administration came in, and Condoleezza Rice put Cuba on their list of nations that represented, in their opinion, outposts of tyranny. So all the schools that were ready to have these exchange programs with them were in retreat. So, but the one thing, though, is this medical project, it was something that people were still aggressively pursuing. But the reality, there are some other dynamics that I won't get into tonight, but I'll just say this much about it, that the more African organizations are involved, those scholarships can be filled in a heartbeat, because everybody that we approached was hands-in. We met with Dr. Dorothy Height, who, in addition to her role with the National Council of Negro Women, which she joined at the age of 25, she let us know that she went to Cuba in 1946, passing through en route to Haiti to fight for women in Haiti to have the right to vote. So she said she was all in, and she was going to contact the Deltas, because she was the president for the last for 10 years at one point in her illustrious career of service to our people. Everyone that we had talked to, regardless of where they were in the spectrum, Marion Barry, because we had approached him, because if anyone knows Marion Barry's history, before he became the first chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he was on the verge of getting a PhD in chemistry. So obviously he was enthused by the program. So everybody we were talking to, and there was a professor at Bowie State University, Dr. Eleanor Walker, who had written Comandante Fidel Castro a letter saying that based on per capita, African people inside U.S. borders were more in need of nurses. And this was our all-time shortage of nurses since our ancestors came in chains 400 years ago. So it was all type of discussion and all type of strategy that was taking place around this. And of course, we know that you had Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and Comandante Fidel Castro contacted the State Department 24 hours after that, and he said that 500 Cuban medical personnel were ready to come to the Gulf region.
Mm-hmm.
And they told him to call back. They called him back, and he called back 48 hours later, and they were rude. And they were like, what do you want? And he said he made a mistake. And they said, about what? He said, yesterday I told you 500 were available. I made a mistake. It's 1,500 because another 1,000 had come forward. And they're packing their supplies, and they're waiting for you to give the okay for them to come. And not only do they want to come and deal with the emergency, but they will remain in the Gulf region until the public hospitals are up and functioning again. And if anybody knows anything about the public health circuit in this country, those were the two worst hospitals in the United States of America. So we were more focused on Kanye West stating the obvious about George Bush at that time. So I can honestly say in this instance, there's a lot of activity. There's a plethora of activity to bring attention to this. The Get Out of Cuba Wave movement is one of the vehicles, but there are other vehicles which we'll talk about tonight. But what we will say about this is 20 years ago, we went to Cuba for the first time, and we had the honor of participating in the Organization of Caribbean and Latin American Youth. And ironically, coincidentally, that was Comandante Fidel's first public comments about the Elian Gonzalez situation. And his comments were concise and simple. He said that using a child to score political points backfired on the United States. And he said the reason it backfired is because the average U.S. citizen learned more about Cuba in 4 months than they had in 41 years. And with the advent of technology, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, I have no hesitation telling you that in the last month and a half, the average U.S. citizen has learned more about the Cuban healthcare system than they have in the last 50 years.
Brother Obi, before I pass the mic to Brother Richard, let me get this clear, and I know you'll make it clear for the listening audience. I read from this published report that the program that Fidel Castro started to educate doctors started in 1999. You said it was the 20th year anniversary.
Yeah.
Of a memorandum.
It was official. Yeah, it was official. The memorandum of understanding was in 2000.
Okay. So it was basically a year after the program had started.
Yeah.
And they said that they wanted. The memorandum was between Cuba.
When they.
Go ahead.
Yes. When they itemized the details.
Okay.
500 scholarships a year were to be offered. The scholarship is a 6-year scholarship to the Latin American School of Medical Sciences. You have to come into the program already seasoned in biology and chemistry. They advise students on this side of the world to at least begin to audit Spanish classes, because eventually your classes will be in Spanish. You have to sign a moral contract that you will come back to this country and practice what they train you to absorb in the poorest, most challenging health situations and environments in this country. And the program is worth $250,000 in terms of its monetary value. And you have to come back. And the young people who have gone through it are practicing in the most challenged areas of this country. And it's the same thing they do for the students in the Caribbean and Africa. Like, for example, Comandante Fidel Castro would always say on Dr. King's birthday that Martin wasn't the only one with a dream. His dream was to ultimately build a medical school, a Cuban medical school on the African continent. But until the resources were made available for that, they would in addition to the 4,000 doctors they have dispatched throughout the African continent, dealing with a multitude of challenges we face in Africa, they would only train the doctors, aspiring doctors in Africa, who would make a commitment to remain in their countries. So in addition to treating the sick in Africa, they were involved in smashing the brain drain in Africa, which many of us feel is worse than all the war, worse than all the famine, worse than all the poverty, worse than all the diseases. So they were helping in a more compassionate way than even treating the sick free of charge. So in that same vein, in that same tradition, from that same sentiment, from that same ethical foundation, that's what the effort was. And the name of the brigade, I was saying Henry Reeve, so in case it comes up later, which I won't mind repeating, Henry Reeve was a Caucasian born in Brooklyn that ended up in Cuba fighting on the side of Cuba during the Spanish-American War. And for those of you who know United States history, you know that the first 7 presidents of the United States were attempting to annex Cuba. And if it wasn't for the resolve of the Cuban people, Cuba would have ended up the way Texas and California did, sucked up like a vacuum cleaner does dirt from Mexico.
Richard, jump in here. But before you do, Richard, listen, we heard Brother Obi and what he said about the memorandum of understanding between black leadership here. And I'd use that term in air quotes, Richard, black leadership here, that they were supposed to, because the Castro administration couldn't do it, that they were supposed to develop 500 students a year of their communities that they represent to come to Cuba for this program. 500 a year. Now, if that had been fulfilled, Richard, look what it would have done to the communities that the black people come from and that they represent. But now, according to this published report I read, it's only 170 that have been developed. And that was as of 2017. So somebody dropped the ball, Richard. And you can see clearly who dropped the ball. I mean, this is incredible, man.
Looking at it from as a part of the dropping the ball, but also Africans in North America, with the need, and I'm emphasizing this phrase, this public health crisis, because this is something that's been, it's obvious that what's being shown is that we have been living with a public health crisis, and we have no infrastructure, and we have no medical staff to assist us that's close to us. Right. So, Brother Obi, what I wanted to do, and you kind of raised the question about Cuba's public health system, because I'm coming to this from the perspective that we need to develop a public health policy to advocate consistently to the political machinery, but more importantly to ourselves, that this is what we need. And we can see at one point, and especially in the urban areas, I see in the 60s when they had the money coming out of the poor people campaign, that people from the community were actually advocating for a public health infrastructure that was close to the people that needed, because of the impoverishness and the health conditions that Black people were living under. So my first question to you is, if you could help us, because Cuba is a good model of how they put together a public health system close to the people to serve them. Are you aware of how their structure is done in Cuba, so that we can possibly use that as a template?
Well, you just called for socialism. seriously, I think that what you're speaking to, and I'm glad that you're speaking to it, it comes down to us understanding our historical relationship in this fight for quality health care as African people. What often gets lost is everything that we need, all of the challenges we face, too often the expression, the activity is usually confined to the never-ending lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And in all actuality, you gave an excellent reference, the Poor People's Campaign, because we have a message for Dr. Willie Barber and the Moral Monday movement that Cuba's greatest army, which is their doctors, this is a true Poor People's Campaign. Not to say that what he's trying to do is not authentic, because Reverend Graylin Ellis Hegler of Plymouth Congregational Church out of the United Church of Christ, who was the D.C. coordinator for the Poor People's Campaign, we told him the same thing. This, because he said, so where do you see the momentum coming out of this? And I smiled at him and said, the real Poor People's Campaign. But I'll get into that later. But we have to remember that, once again, that's why I purposely prefaced in the beginning by saying that we created the National Medical Association because we could not join the American Medical Association in 1896. So while Plessy versus Ferguson is going on, while Booker T. Washington hires George Washington Carver to work at Tuskegee, while Nehanda is leading a revolt against the British in Zimbabwe, same year, we established the National Medical Health Association. A few years later, Booker T. Washington, before he transitions to the ancestors, does what? He starts Negro Health Week, which becomes Negro Health Month. And right around that same time, building off the momentum of the Philadelphia experiment, that great son of Africa, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, publishes another study, The Physique and Health of the Negro American, raising the point that we were more vulnerable in the arena of healthcare in 1905 than we were when we were confined to the slave shacks, the shacks on the plantations, the captivity shacks, rather. And as time has gone on, the struggle for quality healthcare has been part and parcel of our fight for liberation, and it remains that. Now, the fact that because we say that the true definition of America is the Western Hemisphere, looking at what we're in, what we've endured in relationship to a place where our ancestors came to cut sugar and were cutting sugar cane from sun up to sundown, just like we were picking cotton and tobacco from sun up to sundown, and went through the same levels of oppression, went through annexation, went through segregation, went through poverty, went through institutional racism, but waged a revolution, had 300 rebellions and uprisings by the captives, by the way. The first, the most prominent one by an African named Jose Aponte, who was beheaded, and his skull was kept as a trophy and at the port of Havana as a statement of intimidation to others who may want to follow in his footsteps. So they endured a place where the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey had 40 branches of the UNIA, the same place where the first all-African political party, Partido Independiente de Cola, was created in 1908. In that same place, you have a revolution where the leader and the most recognizable and respected and revered face of that revolution said, our medical personnel are our greatest army, greater than the army that fought in the Spanish-American War for 22 years, greater than the guerrillas that fought in the mountains to overthrow a government that no one gave them a chance to defeat militarily, greater than the guerrillas that went to Angola and fought side by side with us against a CIA-trained mercenary installation called UNITA, fought with us in Mozambique against another CIA-trained mercenary installation, RENAMO, fought with us in Guinea-Bissau next to the great Amilcar Cabral. And they say that this army with syringes and stethoscopes and other medical equipment has made more world impact. Whether you're looking at the Chernobyl disaster in 1986, what they did there, whether you're looking at their work and the countless earthquakes that have ravaged our beloved African community in Haiti, whether you're looking at their Operation Project Miracle that they did in conjunction with Venezuela to eradicate blindness and glaucoma in the Americas, whether you're looking at what they did between 2016 and 2018, 400 of them went to Liberia and Guinea and Sierra Leone and eradicated the Ebola pandemic. They have a proven, undeniable track record, and they are ready to come to the United States right now. And the fact that they're in Italy, the fact that France is clamoring for them, the fact that they disembarked a ship and coming out of Britain about a month ago and treated those people who had the most deadly form of the pandemic. And once they got them under control, they sent them back to their beloved Britain. So, and I think that the other important thing to mention is that the nations where they function are not nations that are compatible ideologically with them. And the story that they like to tell the world is about 14, 15 years ago, the First Lady of Honduras at the time was signing a agreement that 7,000 Cuban medical personnel would come to Honduras. And that, and at the same time she was doing that, you had her husband, the president of Honduras at the time, he was in Geneva with the United States pushing through a resolution condemning Cuba for lack of democracy, heavy-handed treatment of the opposition and human rights violations. But at the same time, his wife was begging for their medical personnel to come to Honduras to treat the sick and train their doctors, train young people to come back and be the best doctors that Honduras have ever had in their space. So, I mean, this continues, but they offered to come to 9/11 before Hurricane Katrina. And for the record, they were not rejected. They were just ignored. They were never told no. They were just ignored. They were just ignored. And in this case, this administration has been attacking them, but they're daring us to make the appeal that we've made. And based on the response we got in the initial appeal, which I'll begin to go over as we get more into this conversation, some of the people who signed on to this, and Brother Elliot, as soon as he got it, he called me. and I've known him for a few years now. I've never heard him sound that shocked before when he saw some of the people who signed on to this. And we just have a lot of confidence and we have a lot of momentum and we can just want to build on it. And we think that we're going to be successful. And we understand the apathy. So we feel we're in the frame of mind that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is in when they walked amongst the peace activists that were opposing the Vietnam War and said that our task is to smash the draft. And people thought that that was outrageous. We're in the frame of mind of the four Zimbabweans who attacked Rhodesian and British security forces with rocks, which launched an armed campaign against the second most powerful army, colonial army ever assembled in Africa. Nobody gave them a chance to win. And you look at the laundry list of examples where we made the impossible possible, the unimaginable real. We feel that we are confident that we can pull this off. And it's just a question of our commitment. It's just a question of our tenacity and just remaining committed to the objective.
You know, being as you were laying this out, I was thinking, you know, because again, I'm looking at that, that we need to have this strategic thinking in relationship to our community, because after this here, mm-hmm. virus is over, we need to really start to put things in place. So I'm an advocate for the Malcolm X grassroots movement thing about people assemblies. And I'm thinking
I'm so glad you brought them up, because they did not sign the initial appeal, but 48 hours after it, they got in contact with us and said, add them to it. And we're in a conversation with them right now about the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Lumumba, writing a statement of support in his capacity, but not only doing that, but presenting the appeal to the National Conference of Black Mayors, seeking a unanimous endorsement from them.
Okay.
The same conversation has been going on with Raz Baraka, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. And for those of you who may wonder what the dynamics are around that, let us give you some history. The Malcolm X grassroots movement and the New African People's Organization, who also both of them came on board, they are one of their members is none other than the one and only Asadi Shakur, who has been safe in Cuba for over four decades now, and is on the United States list of was the number one terrorist according to the United States. And on Raz Baraka's side, many people know his father, the great poet and cultural icon, Amiri Baraka, but many people know him for The Dutchman and other poetry, jazz poetry, being one of the fathers of jazz poetry. But people forget that he wrote an essay called Cuba Libre that he gained international recognition for. So when we approached Mayor Baraka and we approached Mayor Lumumba, it was because of their the bloodline they represent in relationship to the Cuban question. So yes, we definitely have been having conversations with the Malcolm X grassroots movement about this, and we hope to be speaking with Mayor Lumumba Jr. very soon. We had a great relationship with the father. We did a lot of work around Libya with him. We did a lot of work around Zimbabwe with him. As a matter of fact, the father was responsible for pushing the National Conference of Black Lawyers to sign the appeal we made to the Obama administration calling for the lifting of sanctions on Zimbabwe right away. So like father, like son, we hope.
And you know, when you bring up Baraka, Elliot, to the point that you were making as far as about the politicians, because it was also Baraka who was able to, in the 70s, bring that convention together. I believe that was around 72, which had all the strategies. And the agenda. Yeah. And in that, I mean, this speaks to the point that I just wanted to emphasize this and emphasize the point that you were raising in relationship to the scholarships being there and the Black mm-hmm. elected officials, because it was the Black elected officials who broke ranks at that time, the Congressional Black Caucus that broke ranks.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. At that time. And so, you know, and that was, you know, as it related to getting pressured by the Israeli lobby, you know, which was the reason why the convention broke down, which would have, you know, been able to put in place this here medical infrastructure to be able to utilize these doctors trained. So,
but let me just say this though, if I may, it's not just on the Congressional Black Caucus. They initially, because if we're going to be honest and authentic tonight about them, I mean, we know them for two things primarily: traveling and photo ops. So the photo op with Fidel, I mean, they wanted to have that. And, you know, they knew that this was there would be something symbolic. But we knew from the very outset that the work identifying the youth who would be eligible for the program, we knew that that would fall on grassroots organizations. And we're glad that Pastors for Peace / IFCO took over that aspect of the program. So they're primarily responsible in terms of setting up a system that where we could funnel people. They were responsible for that. But all of our nationalist organizations have known about this. All of our academic organizations have known about this. Our artistic and cultural organizations have known about this. Our churches have known about this. Our fraternities and sororities have known about this. So the broader community knows about this. Several radio stations have advertised this project over and over and over and over and over and over. Mm-hmm. But there's been a very cowardly, opportunist, and genuine entity within our community, and they wait till we're not around, and they'll get on shows and whisper, there's still racism in Cuba. Mm-hmm. Not even telling you where the origins of it are from, because obviously the origins are from the captivity of our ancestors. And to present and to completely ignore the aggressive steps that they have taken to empower African people culturally and politically. And they do this. So these are the people that are that have been planting seeds of doubt about Cuba, period. So whenever we talk about fighting the blockade, whether we talk about any other things we do to bridge the gap between Africans and the United States and Africans in Cuba and Africans in the rest of the Americas, for that matter, where we are 191 million strong, it is those who cowardly do this. And this is why you guys have laughed in the past when I've done it. This was the reason why I wanted to have a civilized, mature, sophisticated conversation with Philly's own Dr. Umar Johnson, politely warning him about talking reckless about Cuba, because it was tied to work like this. That's why I wanted to do it. It was not to embarrass him. It was not to antagonize him. It was not to create an atmosphere where we sound like two battle rappers on Smack DVD. Nothing of the sort. It was because we considered this a workstation, and those of you, a construction site, if you will, and those of you, and both of you know, the only people that go to construction sites are people who work on them or people interested in working on them. Everyone else moves in the other direction. So if this was something that he wasn't working on, if this is something he wasn't interested in working on, if this was something he didn't have a track record of working on, we were going to politely and lovingly ask him, detour, go in the other direction, let us handle this business here. And so, and not just him, that goes for everyone else that has been doing this. And luckily, to people's credit, this time around, that hasn't happened. But what has been happening is people were starting to talk about Dr. Sebi and others who were talking about more homeopathic remedies for this situation. Mm-hmm. And they were questioning the effectiveness of interferon alpha-2B. And we quickly told them, look here, this is an opportunity then for you, which we can facilitate. We can link you with Cuba's Ministry of Public Health, because green medicine is part of their national health policy. So if you want to use this opportunity to develop a stronger relationship with their green medicine division, with their homeopathic remedy division, you can do that. But please don't use this opportunity to make it seem like what they're doing is not necessary, what they're doing cannot benefit us, and like you brothers did, it's inextricably linked to, on the long term, getting more young people to go there for medical training. And the end result of that is what? More Daniel Hale Williams, more Charles Drews, more Percy Julians, and better yet, more Franz Fanons, more Samuel Panyatwas, the medical doctor who was the number two man in the Zimbabwe African People's Union, more Augustino Nitos, who was a doctor, but also the founder of the movement, the popular movement for the liberation of Angola, more Samora Machel's, because people who forget, in addition to being a faithful revolutionary, before Samora Machel joined the Front for the Liberation of Mozambique, he was a nurse, and his first political activity was protesting the disparity in pay for Portuguese nurses and Mozambican nurses. So we would be looking at getting younger people who would get the ideological training in addition to the medical training, and they'd come back with a total different perspective, which is so necessary right now, because we're trying to transform the island of Black excellence into a training ground for African resistance. And we know that many people don't want to see that happen. And when they witness that taking course, they're going to get tickets to Wakanda and Zamunda. They don't want any parts of that, but that's perfectly okay. And we feel that this is what this will lead to. Also, one of the other things that has to be discussed in relationship to this is because that medical training also deals with what the ultimate challenge is. When we talk about the information divide often, many people don't realize how criminalistic this country is. Now, this country, on U.S. soil, you have the United Nations General Assembly that takes place every September like clockwork. And the only thing that people in this country get to see is a few excerpts from the opening remarks of whoever the U.S. president is who opens it up. That's the tradition. Because Woodrow Wilson founded the League of Nations, whatever, whatever, whatever. But 10 years ago, I accompanied the late Pan-African icon and national hero of Zimbabwe, Comrade Robert Gabriel Mugabe, His Excellency. I was part of the press team that accompanied him to a private session between African nations and the World Health Organization. And it was revealed at that during that discussion that non-communicable diseases, strokes, heart attacks, cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure had emerged as the number one killer of the human being, surpassing HIV/AIDS, surpassing cholera, surpassing malaria, surpassing smallpox, surpassing measles as the number one killers of human beings. It was projected that between 2010 and 2038, they were anticipating 57 million deaths on this planet. And when the question was posed, why is that number so alarmingly high? Obviously, that has genocidal implications. That's more people than all the losses in the history of the wars of this planet from the beginning of time. And the reason was because they were saying because of global pollution, which has no boundaries, when pandemics of an environmental sort invade your territorial space, people with respiratory-related illnesses will be the first to perish. They are the first, most vulnerable. And that is the reason why you are seeing what you see now, exactly. And because those diseases I mentioned, our demographics rates are triple the rates of the entire nation. This is why this is a problem. This is why we need the Cubans here right this minute. Right this second. And we just feel, you know, that everybody all across the spectrum, regardless of how they see our overall situation, we'll agree on this. Look at who we got. We got, like I said, Dr. Lucy Norville Perez, bless her heart, first National Medical Association president to lead a delegation to Cuba. Dr. Abdul Aleem Muhammad, the former Minister of Health and Human Services for the Nation of Islam, still has his clinic, Abundant Life Health Attainment Center in Mitchellville, Maryland. Now, this is the one that shocked everyone. Reverend Dr. James Winkler, the President and General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. That's right, I said the National Council of Churches. Now, I have to say, he said he's not ready to endorse the fourth push for interferon alpha-2B because the jury's still out. And it was a testament to his honesty. And he pleaded with me every platform I have to mention that. So if people are listening, get that back to him. man, we got, and that was made possible by Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell. For people who don't know her, she's the modern day Dorothy Day. If you know the history of the social gospel. And she was one of the people, when she was the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, who helped negotiate Elian Gonzalez's safe return back to Cuba. And when she found out about this, she reached out to us and said, count me in. We have the daughter of Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the Honorable Samia Nkrumah, as last Monday represented his death in 1972. And for people who know the history, Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah and the Convention People's Party were the first government and party to come out in support of the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. In terms of elected officials, we have Malika Sanders Fortier, a state senator of the 23rd District of Alabama, who has also agreed to present this to the National Conference of Black State Legislators. Too often we forget about them. We mention the National Conference of Black Mayors, and of course we mention the Congressional Black Caucus, overkill in many cases. We forget about the National Conference of Black State Legislators, who in this instance may be more valuable. For those of you who know about the affluent community of our people in PG County, not all PG counties are affluent, but our people focus in on that because of that. The city council at large, my old college classmate, the Honorable Calvin Hawkins, supported this. Former Green Party presidential candidate and U.S. House of Representative to the 11th District of Georgia, Cynthia McKinney, signed on to this. In terms of history, the Honorable Alice Wyndham, the first wave of African Americans, as they are called, repatriates to Ghana. For those of you who know the famous picture of Brother Malcolm in Ghana with his finger and his dimple, part of the solution, part of the problem with the dashiki on, this is the sister who took that picture. And 24 hours after the death of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, the night before the March on Washington, Alice Wyndham, Maya Angelou, Julian Mayfield, W. Alpheus Hinton, Preston King, Jim Lacey, and others marched in the U.S. Embassy in solidarity with the March on Washington. And they had a list of demands. One of the demands was no more U.S. intervention in Cuba, no more U.S. intervention in Vietnam. So we have Ada Rodriguez, the comedian, who's about to have her first HBO special. We have SNCC alum Dr. Dorothy Ladner and Mukasa Dada, formerly known as Willie Ricks. Thanks to Empress Chi, Mumia Abu-Jamal are supporting this. Ramona Africa, Pam Africa are supporting this. Thanks to Russell Maroon Schultz, the fighter, U.S. prisoner of war, through his son, we have his support. Through Russell Schultz, the son, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill signed on to this. Dr. Leonard Jeffries signed on to this. Dr. Greg Carr signed on to this. Dr. Amma Mazana signed on to this, representing Afrocentricity International. Dr. Bernita Thompson, the director and founder of Roots Activity Learning Center, signed on, one of the mothers of the African independent school movement in this country. Dr. Kelly Harris, the director of Africana Studies at Seton Hall University, who has approached the National Association of Black Political Scientists and the African Heritage Studies Association. Dr. John Henry Clark's organization, who accompanied Amiri Baraka to Cuba in 1960 for the one-year anniversary of the revolution, and they climbed up the Sayara Maestra Mountains. You guys, we forget about Dr. Clark's political activity. People just make it seem like he was just in the classroom. Dr. John Henry Clark in 1961, in three occasions, ran guns from Harlem, New York, to Monroe, North Carolina, to help Robert Williams and the NAACP branch defend ourselves. Dr. Tony Browder signed on to this. We have a brother out of Canada, Dr. Isaac Saney, who's one of the coordinators of the Canadian Network on Cuba, who we're working in conjunction with on this. I mean, Sandra Isidori, if that name sounds familiar, she just won the Pan-African Film Festival for her new documentary, Fela and Me. And she was then Sandra Smith in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, who gave Fela Kuti the autobiography of Malcolm, which he credits with turning him around.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, we D. Bilal Sunni Ali, our brother, he signed on in support of this. I mean, Fred Hampton Jr. signed on in support of this.
Do you see this being the possibility of creating synergy again within the African-American community around, you know, the effort and you know, just the whole thing of health itself.
Yes, I do. I, and the inspiration for this was the statement in support of Cuba that the great journalist Bill Worthy did in 1960 when Comandante Fidel came to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. When you look at the broad-based support, and you've got media, you've got church, you've got politicians, you've got academicians, and the one that touches me the most, I have to say, though, is my 16-year-old student, Zahir Muhammad. He's the president of the Black Student Union at DeMatha Catholic High School, and he's already working to get all the Black student unions at all the Catholic high schools in this country to endorse this unanimously. So that is the one that touches me the most, because I've been teaching him since he was 9 years old. And just to see him in the 11th grade.
Who's the 14-year-old?
And his 14-year-old brother yesterday got an article published about this appeal in the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. His 14-year-old brother. And next week, brothers, the Mass Emphasis Positive Action and Creativity Youth Brigade, which is the advocate affiliate to the Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company, the young people are creating a mini documentary called Get Out Cuba Way. And I purposely, that wasn't incorrect English on my part. That's the way they're calling it. And this is the Get Out Cuba Way movement. And so they're doing a mini documentary. And Brother Elliot, I just sent you the song a few minutes ago. I sent it to you. So whenever you can, it's a few minutes, if you could play that for the audience so they could hear this 20-year-old MC who I've been teaching since he was 12 years old through the Sankofa homeschool community. Shout out to the Sankofa homeschool community who signed on to this as well. So, yeah, I mean, the support is there. And we're building up more and more and more and more and more. And we're not going to be deterred. Shoot at the Cuban embassy all you want. It means nothing.
Now, that happened yesterday. I wasn't aware of that.
Thursday.
Okay.
Some stupid cowboy. But once again, it's because of the political culture of this country. You try to assassinate Comandante Fidel Castro 635 times. You openly endorsed in 1983 the Cuban American National Foundation, which was a cover for terrorist cells inside Miami, two of them in particular, Alpha 66 and Brothers to the Rescue. And of the 635 assassination attempts on the life of Comandante Fidel Castro, they're responsible for at least 500. Two terrorists, Orlando Dr. Death Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles, were walking freely in Miami because of their commitment. This speaks to the other issue of immigration that, once again, because of the lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans, we always talk about, but contextually is off. Because there are certain countries, if you come here saying you are hell-bent on overthrowing those governments, you don't have any challenges getting in this country. So when you come to this country out of Cuba and you say that you are working for the demise of the Cuban Revolution, you don't have any obstacles in immigration, you come right through. You're like an NBA player at a club on a Friday night. No problems at all. If you come here from Eritrea and say you want to do away with Afwerki, you come through. You come here from Venezuela and say you would want Guaido, forget Maduro, you want to bury him next to Chavez, you get to come through. You come here from Zimbabwe and say, hey, Mnangagwa is worse than Mugabe, you get to come through. You come here from Bolivia and you say, I'm here to make sure the evil Morales and those dirty, filthy Indians never come back to power in Bolivia, you get to come through. So this illusion about immigration policy in this country, immigration policy in this country is contingent on whether you're willing to be an extended mouthpiece and an extended agent and an extended culprit in regime change if the United States has a fundamental problem with the government of your country. So in this case, Cuba, there's no country on earth they hate more than Cuba. And, and ironically, what ends up happening is based on pressure, certain politicians opportunistically posture. And now I'm speaking to the high-profile field trip of former U.S. President Barack Obama a few years ago, because if you remember his initial campaign for his first presidency, standing in front of those terrorists in Miami, he said, I'm 47 years old, and the people of Cuba have never known human rights. And Comandante Fidel Castro had to tell him to be quiet. He told him, you know, quietly, be quiet. And then he went there, and Raul Castro told him that his efforts were rather insufficient because he was not genuinely committed to getting the blockade lifted. And while his wife, now in her leisure, gets her groove on to de-nice during the DJ quarantine, she should call for the Cuban medical personnel to come to the country. It won't hurt them at this point. If he was so committed to getting the blockade lifted, he should use his platform to lend his voice to this effort. Since Bernie Sanders, you know, had one of those knee-jerk reactions that white liberals are so famous for, and said that Fidel should have a bad rap, he should lend his voice to this. I mean, of course, it'd be distant from us because, I mean, you know, when you talk about the blockade on Cuba being lifted from the far left to the far right, it's an established sentiment. On the far right is the Vatican. On the far right is certain members of the Republican Party. On the far right are members of the Democratic Party saying that the blockade should be lifted. And then those of us who, you know, in the spirit of the Africans who wage rebellions there, in the spirit of the Africans who formed the first political party there, in the spirit of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who had 40 branches there, that's where we're coming from when we call for the lifting of the blockade. So, but at the same time, those of you who are so, who rub shoulders with Bernie all the time, those of you who rub shoulders with Obama all the time, those of you who rub shoulders with Michelle all the time, you need to put a bug in their ear and tell them that they need to raise their voice. And let's just see what happens. We're not dependent on it, but, you know, we're not dependent on them. It would be the cherry on the sundae. But when you have the type of pressure that we plan to unleash, especially during this election year, ain't no telling what we're going to come up with.
We're going to take a
break. So let's just see what happens.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can get involved.
Play that song, man.
I'm going to play it. I'm going to play it when we come back from break. I see it on my email. When we come back from break, get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Our guest tonight is activist, playwright, and journalist, and am I still there?
Yeah, we're
I think
here,
I am.
Man.
Okay. We'll be right back.
We ain't going nowhere.
We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, as other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. Then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
Preachers and leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. You can't feel it? When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them? Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk? Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine. Your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again.
Damn it, we're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and got it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect.
When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America, that's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
False alarm. How can we breathe when smog is among other things like passing bills that were obviously wrong? I'm probably better off in a house, or is that what they want? I know my mind has been in twisted places, conspiracy theories mixed with lateness. Like, why Cuba out here fighting for nations, and out of 45 countries, the U.S. ain't asked for Nathan? And I ain't even talking about the antiviral they created back in the 80s, but Cuba's still willing to put all hands on deck and serve us like waiters, man. They known for it. Sending their doctors like troops and indoctrinating our doctors, well, excuse me, intellectually inspired so we can get down to the truth. But what happened to it's all about the youth? If you think about it, we've been out of school for a few. But of course, that's on nobody's mind right now. We just enjoying our free time right now. Catching up on old folks for lost time right now. But you think it's smart to take a break in a time like now? But let me get back on topic. See, isn't it interesting how Italy had the highest amount of cases? Then soon after, they requested Cuba's help for their patients. But now the U.S. numbers are higher than all. While the people who were in office waiting for trauma on call, Trump said we should save money and fire them all. I mean, what should we do? As a people, I mean, what can we do? Let's come together to support something that has already been in the works. Look up Alpha Number 2B. It honestly speaks for itself. So maybe it's time for us to get out of Cuba's way. Let them combat for our health. I mean, they risk their own country's lives for the sake of others by letting in a stranded cruise ship into their dock with people who tested positive who didn't grow up in their crop. But not only did they let them in their borders, they treated and kept them there until they were healthy enough to go back home to their families. They have proven themselves on many occasions. Let's not let history repeat itself, and instead, let history march forward.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and you just heard from the young man there. We're joining the conversation this evening with activist, journalist, and playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Egbona Jr. And we're talking about Cuba and the need for our people, just like the young man asked that question, Richard. You heard that question he asked. What should we do and what can we do? Young 16-year-old brother asked that question.
He's 20.
Okay. Give his name.
Yeah, he's 20. He just turned 20 last year. He did a poem called "Vision" in a video about Cuba's efforts in Venezuela with Venezuela to eradicate blindness and glaucoma in the Americas, called Operation Project Miracle. So he reached out to me and he said that he wanted to do something around this, and we just gave him the material. And at a time where we have more critics of popular culture, then we have liquor stores and Subway sandwich shops in our community, we opt to just go ahead and train the young people, empower them, and give them the exposure. And then this way, instead of waiting for a handful of artists that have the courage to lend their voice to causes, as opposed to just having a message, we can go ahead and create them and produce them, or create an atmosphere that will create and produce them. So instead of in case we can't get in touch with dead prayers, in case we can't get in touch with Immortal Technique, in case we can't get in touch with Public Enemy, in case we can't get in touch with KRS-One, in case we can't get in touch with Mos Def and Talib Kweli, in case we can't get in touch with Black Thought, we've got the young people in our community who, with the proper exposure, who with the proper nurturing, who with the proper channeling, they'll be more potent than those artists were in the spirit of evolution.
Who's playing those instruments in that?
That's the great composer, another lifetime friend of Cuba, the great William Lowe, internationally accomplished composer and arranger. And when he found out that we were doing this, he lent us that music.
Okay, good. Okay.
So we thank him, too. I was definitely going to mention that. And he hasn't even heard this yet. He wants to wait until the documentary's ready, the mini doc. But we shared the music on Monday on another show that we were on. And of course, we wanted to give love to Time for Awakening. So we hope that you guys liked it, and we hope that your listeners liked it too. That's a 20-year-old.
Okay. And his 14-year-old brother is the one that wrote the introduction to the,
No. That's Zion Yutzi. You just heard, you were talking about Zahir Muhammad, 16-year-old, 11th grader, president of the Black Student Union in DeMatha, and his brother, 14-year-old, Kaleem Muhammad. Yeah, we got some young people, man.
Okay, yeah, I know it.
And that's some young people, yeah.
You know, You know, before, we got a couple calls online. Before I go to them, let me mention this briefly, and I know you'll go into it in more in depth. we see some of the things happening around your activism and what you've been doing around getting Cuba involved to come to the communities here to help out with this pandemic that's going on and really hitting our communities hard. But we see the propaganda machine in motion, if we're watching. Mike Pompeo, who is the Secretary of State and former CIA director, made comments about South Africa and Qatar and a few other countries using Cuban doctors and basically issuing ultimatums and threats to these countries about doing it. These people have the pulse on what's going on. They know what's been happening. They hear the conversations. It's no need in us hiding because they know what we're saying. They know what's going on. So they have to put the propaganda machine out front first to get black folks scared. Almost like when our ancestors was on a plantation and they take one of our ancestors up and beat him in front of the whole plantation with 30 other men and women standing there.
Yeah.
It's a scare tactic. I just want to mention that because in case some of our listeners, audience hadn't been aware of the statements that's been coming out of this White House.
And you want me to touch on it after we take the call?
Yeah, I'm going
I won't say anything now.
Good. let me go grab a couple of these calls.
Go ahead.
Let's go to Toronto. Let's go to 647. 647.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm here. How you doing? Can you hear me? I don't think you can. You still there, caller? Let's put him back on hold. Maybe he'll get it together.
Okay.
Let's go. Okay. Let's go to caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Caller, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. What's going on here with these phones here? Yeah. Let's go to 215. 215. 215. Let's put another one back on hold here. Let's go to 646. 646?
Yeah, can you hear me, Elliot?
Yes, sir. I know. Okay, I know it wasn't me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What's going on? Brother Obi, as always, it's good to hear your voice, dropping your knowledge and wisdom in regards to this whole Cuba thing and its medical efforts around the world. It's funny, I was looking at Paul Nelson's page, I think it was today or yesterday, and they had my niece in there. She's a doctor who got her training in Cuba.
Oh, what's your niece's name?
Okay.
Her name is Alyssa Barber.
Okay.
Hmm.
Yeah, she, I don't know if she still does it now, because I really haven't spoken to her in a while, but at one time, she was the coordinator of the community, you know, in the East Coast, getting into the school in Cuba, like overseeing, like, the registration, the information, and all of that, when they applied for the school in Cuba.
Oh, you know what? I don't want to cut you. I don't want to cut across you because I was going to read an article. Somebody produced an article in the Black Agenda Report talking about your niece.
Yeah, that's her. Yeah,
okay.
That's her.
Oh.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, I know that she's when they had the crises in Haiti a couple of years ago. I know she went there for 2 weeks to assist. I know that she's went other places to assist. You know, what's so unfortunate is that America, who needs assistance, they don't want to deal with the Cuban, you know, doctors and things of that nature. But it's funny, I had to go into the hospital for a day this week. And let me tell you, they had nurses, they had people that were in the Navy, nurses, and everything in Harlem Hospital in New York. Now, up until I think a week ago, the whole hospital was basically under, you know, corona. All of the patients in the hospital on the wards and everything was corona. A nurse friend of mine, she was telling me that you had people going out to lunch, coming back, and death was happening. People would, when they come back an hour, the whole room would be dead. They right now got three refrigerated trucks outside the hospital with bodies. I mean, it's really, really crazy. And, you know, I don't know why this country has such a problem and such issues with what the Chinese medical establishment is trying to do in assisting people. Because, you know, let's be honest, their work around the world is phenomenal. You know, nobody, I think, honestly, in the world is probably producing the quality of doctors that Cuba are. I could be wrong, I'm not sure. But I would say, from what I observe, they're producing some hell of a doctors.
Yes, they are. That's why that's why we're fighting for this. And we're gonna keep fighting too.
And I just hope that y'all are able to do something and get the information out to the public. Because, listen, I always say this. If you want to become a doctor, and I don't know if you want to become a specialist or not, Cuba is the place to go, because you got people coming out here with close to $250,000 in debt that go to these colleges to become doctors. Now, the chances, if you any good and you get lucky, yeah, you could pay it off in maybe 10 years. But that type of burden is incredible. And I don't even, be honest with you, feel that America trains their doctors as good as Cuba does. I just don't see it. Because anytime I've dealt with a doctor from Cuba, they always deal with you a little bit better than me. They're more personable. They're more inclined to look at alternative type ways of dealing with things. You know, it's just a whole different vibe to me. But look, brother, keep up the good work. And listen, man, thank it's you. Always a pleasure hearing you whenever you are on this show or call show or any other show. You know, your man Wilbur Leon, dropping your knowledge and your science. So thank you again, brother. You can put me on hold, all right. Brother Elliot.
Thanks for your call, brother. let's go back again to Toronto. 647, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Good, I can.
Beautiful. Yes, I wanted Brother Obi to talk about the fact that in Canada, Canada played a role in helping Robert Franklin Williams get to Cuba. There was a couple by the name, the brothers, the white brother's name was Vern Olson, and his wife, I can't remember her name, I met them, but they used to bring the Crusader. When Rob came to Cuba, he put together a Radio Free Dixie, a radio show. Rob and Mabel Williams had Radio Free Dixie. And the Olsons helped them. And I basically wanted Brother Obi to talk about, you know, the role that Robert Williams played in supporting the Cuban Revolution and the African Revolution and black people all around the world.
Yeah, what's up, Brother Norman?
Hey, how you doing?
I need to holler at you, man.
I signed that petition, but I don't know if it went through.
You know what? I'll tell you what. I'll talk to you about that. And we're working with Isaac Saini and those guys in Canada right now.
Saini that's my man out of Halifax, Nova Scotia.
He told me. Robert Williams. Not only Robert Williams, but Julian Mayfield, who helped Robert Williams get to Cuba. But Robert Williams was very instrumental in the early days of Cuban solidarity. And there's so many people. I mean, many people don't know that Joe Louis, led the first delegation to Cuba Christmas week in 1959.
Yes.
Then in 1960, Robert Williams comes into play. Julia Mayfield and Mary Baraka, Harold Cruz, John Henry Clark, and all of these guys. But Robert Williams was very Bill Worthy. Robert Williams was very instrumental, extremely early, and that work that he did. Of course, many people know the work he did that sparked the Revolution Action Movement, that sparked the Black Panther Party. So there's so many people when we're doing work around Cuba that we're evoking the spirit of. So we, in the video that we did about the Operation Project Miracle to eradicate the blind, eradicate blindness in the hemisphere, we definitely gave due to Robert F. Williams. And no question about it, before it was fashionable, before it was trendy. And I think that the mistake we make, Brother Norman, all the time is when we do talk about Cuba, we talk about Comandante Fidel and Che all the time, and we forget about all of these different African links that we have to Cuba. For some people like yourself, it's Robert Williams. For others, it's Assata Shakur. For others, it's Mugabe, who is a Jose Marti Award recipient. For other people, it's Thomas Sankara. For other people, is Josephine Baker. For other people, is Nicholas Guillen, who's called the Langston Hughes of Cuba. For other people, it's Nelson Mandela.
Great poet.
Oh, yes. And it's funny, the fact that Pompeo attacked South Africa, that's fallen on deaf ears. Zuma and Mandela are Jose Marti recipients. The bond between Cuba and South Africa, that's an unbreakable bond. That one's going nowhere there. And it's the same thing. As much as these neo-colonialist governments in Africa disgust us, the one thing that's never going to happen is they're never going to turn their back on Cuban medical personnel. So, that works. So for them to, and ultimately for us too, in addition, we have another project in connection to this called Cuba Amor Africa, where we feel that the time has come for us to begin to generate the capital to finance Cuba's medical efforts on the African continent through the African Union in Washington and their United Nations office in New York, with the National Conference of Black Lawyers and the National Bar Association there to facilitate that process, especially since we're 1 year removed from the year of return, where Akufo Addo of Ghana, who's obviously a puppet for the West, working with Rosa Whitaker, to make the U.S.-Africa Business Exchange, which is now a component of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they're boasting that they almost raked in $2 billion. And we're saying for a tenth of that $2 billion, for all those Africans who are going to Ghana, that and their only interaction with the Africans in Ghana is going to be in a few propositions, clean my toilets, cook my food, water out my plants. We're saying that they can go to Ghana and we can begin to generate capital to help Cuba's medical efforts in Ghana, help their medical efforts in Nigeria, help their medical efforts in a country like Zimbabwe, which is under sanctions. So you're talking about a blockaded nation that has lost nearly $200 billion since Kennedy imposed their blockade in 1962, that's going around the world, especially on the African continent, not only training the future doctors of those nations, but they're training the doctors who refuse to come to Washington, to come to New York, to come to Los Angeles, to go to Sweden, to go to Denmark, but will stay in Burkina Faso, will stay in Guinea-Bissau, will stay in Nigeria, will stay in Sao Tome and Principe. Those are the only ones they train. So with more discussion about investing in Africa, we should invest in Cuba's medical work on the African continent. But in addition to that, every time we do Cuba work, we're automatically evoking the spirit of Robert Williams. And Robert Williams was very vital in his work at a critical time where many people were afraid to do it. And we believe that it is the Cuba work that Robert Williams did that made Thurgood Marshall turn over a dossier on him to the FBI in New York
City. That's right. That is right. And one other thing. William Sales, who is a brother who wrote a book on Malcolm, his daughter was trained in, she's a doctor. She got her medical training in Cuba. That's William Sales, who wrote the book, I forgot the name of, haven't seen your moment, but William Sales, he's a Philadelphia, born and raised in Philly.
Yeah. And yeah, so we had talked to Brother Isaac about doing a show with you in Canada to show the unity between our efforts.
Oh, that's done.
So we will definitely be in touch with you. And always good to hear from you, Brother Norm.
Thank you.
Peace, man. Boy, you're a known man. Your activity and work speaks for itself, Obi.
I'm not sure about that. I don't want to be too known, man. We just want
to
work.
Let's go back to 215. 215, are you there?
Yeah, Brother Elliot?
Yes.
Yeah, how you doing, Brother Elliot?
Great.
Yeah, I'm going to apologize to you and Brother Richard and Brother Obi. When you came to me, Elliot, I didn't realize I had myself on mute by mistake.
Don't worry about it.
That's why you came to me. I didn't realize. Mm-hmm. I felt so embarrassed. But anyway, Brother, it's good to hear you. Good to hear you and Brother Richard and your distinguished guest, Brother Obi. Brother Obi, how you doing, my brother?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. All praises be. You know, Brother Obi, I don't know where to begin. I just want to first, but you'll talk about Cuba in the context of Cuba. You were absolutely right when you was telling Brother Rich and Brother Elliot several minutes ago about how, like you said, if you want to get in and get in the good graces of the so-called United States imperialists, you have to be anti, whether it be Brother anti-Castro or anti-Bolivia, anti-Evo Morales, anti-Chavez or Maduro. And a prime example of that right here in Philadelphia, Brother Obi, we got a black radio station and a midday host who has a connection with Al Sharpton. He had interviewed this Iranian sister right after the United States assassinated the general over there in Iraq. And mm-hmm. This sister, she was bad-mouthing I'm having a senior moment, so I forgot the general's name and stuff. Well, the general was assassinated by the drone strike over there in Iraq. She was bad-mouthed and said she was glad, and she speaks for the for the people of Iran and everything like that. And I called her, because he wouldn't let nobody question her. He had her on, and she ran her mouth for like about maybe 45. I mean, he wasn't taking no calls. And after he finished interviewing her, I called up. I said, well, brother, I said, to be honest with you, I said, and he was saying about how she's been on news shows on CNN and Fox News. I said, of course they're going to have somebody like her. I said, because she fits the profile. I said, you think they're going to have somebody on there that I said, just as many people that's like her that's against Iran or against the leadership of Iran, you're going to find many Iranians that's for it. But they're not going to promote them. I said, that's part of the propaganda to have somebody like her on there. I said, and I told the host, I said, it's no different when they do with Cuba. I said, of course they're going to go down to Miami and find some racist white Cuban, the bad-mouthed Brother Castro and stuff. I said, of course they're going to do that. I said, man, that's the game they've been playing for years. You know what I mean? So we always got to be aware of that, But anyway, Brother Obi, I want to say this to you, brother. I was educated about Brother Fidel, Comrade Fidel, by a good friend of mine and stuff, Brother Wayne Moore, who Brother Ellen I'm familiar with. He's the ancestor now. He was, I guess he was like a mentor to me. If he was living right now, brother, he would embrace you, because he loved Brother Fidel. He was the type of brother, he would call the white stations, conservative stations, I'm going back towards the late 50s, 60s, he would go to battle with these white boys over Fidel, because they would be saying all kinds of derogatory stuff. He was so intellectual. He would talk to these people in such a calm manner. He never raised his voice. He was so articulate in his speech, brother, that he would chop their head off verbally. He would hit them with facts, and they would fly off the handle, these white boys, because they couldn't handle it. He was talking about how great Fidel, and he would always bring up the African connection to Fidel, like you said, with people like Robert Williams, and he would talk about how Cuba, help support the struggle in Africa, support people when the United States would support Zimbabwe and stuff like that. How Fidel made sure he supported the troops in Angola against Zimbabwe and everything like that. I mean, this brother was so dynamic, Brother Obi. I mean, he was just like a walking encyclopedia when it came to Cuba. He was like a mentor to me, and like I said, he educated me about Brother Fidel. You know what I mean? He was a beautiful human being, man. And like I said, brother, he would love you, man. He would embrace you if he was here physically right now. Brother, he would love you, bro. Trust me when I tell you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I appreciate what you said about and I close with this, brother. Oh, it's so sad that so many of our people are ignorant when it comes to Cuba. I heard some of our misguided people here right into this day, they'll go along with the United States propaganda. They'll badmouth the Cuban people. They'll badmouth Comrade Fidel, Comrade Raul. They'll badmouth them and stuff. Even the current president, they'll badmouth him and stuff like that because they ignorant.
Without even knowing his name.
What was that, Brother Obi? I'm saying it again.
I said without even knowing his name.
Exactly, that's correct. And the ignorance, like Brother Elliams always say, our people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And some of our people, they're ignorant to what's going on. That's why they go along with the nonsense. That's why when the United States bomb a country like Libya or Iraq, you have misguided Negroes say, oh, we just bombed Iraq or we just bombed Libya, like they part of this United States. You know, I mean, just ignorance. That's why brothers like you, Brother Obi, it's so important to try to educate our people so they won't get caught up in this ignorance and stuff. And I don't want to say special praise to Brother Jay's sister, who's a doctor. Brother Jay, if you're still listening, I wish your sister well. She's doing a beautiful work, brother, and she should be applauded for what she's doing, and may the Creator Allah bless her to keep doing what she's doing, because she's doing a beautiful work. And Brother Obi, you keep doing what you're doing. Keep educating our people around the country and around the world about the great works of the Cuban people and Brother Fidel and Sheikh Shabara and everybody. Keep our people educated, brother, and wake up the masses, because you need it, brother. And I thank you and I thank Brother Elliot and Brother Richard for giving the opportunity to talk to you tonight. You're doing a great work, brother, and keep it up. Don't be deterred. You're going to be successful.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your call, brother.
You're welcome, Brother Elliot.
Brother Obi, took some of the callers, and I mentioned about the propaganda machine that's at work now. I didn't know too much about this Pompeo beside him, you know, his position there with the government. But I'm looking here, and I see something strangely familiar here with him, his background. He was a Harvard graduate, and he was editor of the Harvard Law Review. And that sounds that sounds strangely familiar, don't it, Richard?
Yeah.
But you know, I'm just looking at this guy's background. He's before he became politician, he founded an aviation parts firm and an oil field supply company. So all of this, go ahead. I know you want to kind of mention some things in reference to it. Go ahead.
Actually, not really. Because,
okay.
I think that what it is. The methodology of the Cold War, it's outdated.
Okay.
And the thing is, like I said, when Comandante Fidel said 20 years ago at the Organization of Caribbean and Latin American Youth, the average U.S. citizen learned more about Cuba in 4 months than they did 20 years. All the energy and time that they have put into the demonizing and isolating of Cuba, it has failed. I'm 50 years old now. So I was 14 years old when Scarface came out, the Brian De Palma film. And for those people who basically our community looks at that film and glorifies the blue collar crime wave and the cocaine. But that movie was an anti-Castro, anti-Cuban revolution movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the beginning of the movie, it's about the Mario boat lift, where the people who were part of the Bay of Pigs invasion, where the people who were involved in, they were officers for the mafia when Lucky Luciano had a doll factory in Sicily, and through the dolls, they would transport heroin from Sicily to Havana to the ports of New York before the revolution prevailed. These people were beneficiaries of that process. They were beneficiaries of the gambling empire of Maya Lansky, and that changed. So what happened was they would not adapt to the spirit of the revolution, so they left, and they opted to come to Miami. And 3 years later, Ronald Reagan helped them establish the Cuban American National Foundation, and the slogan was, from proletarians to profitarians. And that movie, because the original Scarface, directed by Howard Hughes, was in 1932. It was about the life of Al Capone.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the narrative switch in 1932 from a gangster in Chicago to Tony Montana, a fictitious character who is hell-bent on, and they executed a former Central Committee member of the Cuban Communist Party who had been kicked out of Cuba because he had betrayed the revolution, but they wanted to execute him anyway. And Frank Lopez, who Tony Montana ends up working for, carries that out. But you Godfather fans, Hyman Rock, the fictitious character, is really Maya Lansky, who before the revolution was built several casinos in Cuba and was involved in the prostitution racket in Cuba. But people in the United States no longer see Cuba through the eyes of Charlie Luciano, through the eyes of Sam Giancana, through the eyes of Frank Costello, through the eyes of Vito Genovese, through the eyes of Carlo Gambino. We see through Cuba through the eyes of Mugabe, through the eyes of Malcolm, through the eyes of Robert Williams, through the eyes of Assad Shakur, through the eyes of Kwame Ture, through the eyes of Julian Mayfield, through the eyes of Josephine Baker, through the eyes of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, through the eyes of Thomas Sankara, through the eyes of Nelson Mandela, through the eyes of Amiri Baraka, through the eyes of Common Sense, who made a song on his Like Water for Chocolate album, a tribute song to Assad Shakur, through the eyes of Nehanda Obiadun, through the eyes of M1 of Dead Press, who we directed three albums of music calling for the lifting of the blockade on Cuba and the lifting of sanctions on Zimbabwe. That's who we see Cuba through the eyes of now. That's why we can get 20-year-olds to make music about this project, and that's why we're pushing for the Henry Reed Medical Brigade to come to the United States and treat COVID-19 victims, train medical personnel not used to functioning during a pandemic, work in conjunction with the American Black Nurses Association, with the Black Nurses Association, National Medical Association, and the American Medical Association, and we're pushing for interferon alpha 2B to be made available to people who need it so desperately. That's why we're on tonight. So we are glad we were able to transmit all this information selflessly, but we're on because we're part of a fight. We're on because, and for all people right now who have been having Zoom chats about this, for people who are on YouTube talking about it, for people, for social commentators who flap their lips like dolphins and sharks flap their tails, they can get in on this fight. And those of you who are part of the Malcolm X Admiration Society, because so are we, you can be part of this fight because you know how Malcolm felt about the Cuban Revolution. So this gives you a chance not only to quote Malcolm, not only to impersonate Malcolm, but to continue a fight that Malcolm left behind for you to work on. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and like we said, we are going to tell Reverend Willie Barber of the Moral Monday Movement, this is a poor people's campaign, because at a time where 784 million people on this planet live on $1.90 or less a day, at a time where 20 of the 25 nations on the planet, 22 are in Africa, and the so-called African-American, the U.S.-born African, is 21% of the poor in this country, even though we're 12% of the population. Here's a country that has gone through the same cycle of poverty, and they are the face of medicine on the planet today. So this is something, and for those of you, whether you're part of the conscious generation, whether you're part of the woke generation, keep in mind, people sleepwalk with their eyes wide open. So if you want to be part of a fight, if you want to see the difference between articulate, if you want to make the transition, the quantum leap from articulating ideas eloquently, passionately, to executing those ideas, this is your fight right here. This is your fight. And the fact that we've been able to get so many passionate, committed people who look at our situation in multiple different ways, but we agree on this. Kwame Ture used to say, we lack unity in thought. We don't lack unity in action. So everyone that you see on this appeal, and the way that you guys can get a look at this appeal, for those of you who haven't gotten a chance to see it yet, we even utilized social media for this one, Brother Elliot. So hashtag get out of Cuba way. Hashtag unblock Cuba, hashtag Cuban blockade inhumane. And the website is getoutcubaway.com. Getoutcubaway.com, as we say in D.C. So that the website is getoutcubaway.com. The Instagram hashtags, there are three. Hashtag getoutofcubaway, hashtag unblock Cuba, hashtag Cuban blockade inhumane. The strategy is simple. If you've got newspapers that you feel should run a story on this appeal, do what the San Francisco Bayview newspaper did. Do what the Washington Informer newspaper did. And that, if you got churches in Philadelphia, and I say this as this is the place where Richard Allen and Absalom Jones established the Free African Society in 1794, we got to have some churches in Philadelphia that should be part of this. Go out and find them. But those of you who are part of the university and academic circuit, all the student organizations in Philadelphia, they should be part of this fight. For those of you who are in the fraternities and sororities, you should be part of this fight. There is no organization in our community that is genuinely committed to our uplift. And in this case, you can't say, well, you don't got time for Africa. You got to focus on what's happening right here. This is something you confront when you walk out the door. My fault, you can't even come out of the door because of it. So there is no excuse this time. When we deal with Africa, some of you say that's an ambitious undertaking, and we understand why you feel that way. We understand the damage of the amputated narrative of the collective African experience, but you can't say anything about this one. This is one of those. If you're a journalist, if you're a clergy, if you're a business person, if you belong to grassroots organizations, if they're local in character, if they're national in character, if you're a nationalist, if you're a new African, if you're a Nation of Islam, if you represent the legal sector of our community, if you represent the medical sector of our community, if you are a children's advocate, there is no escaping this. And this is the time for us. And when our activity has that type of unifying character, this is when you begin to see the quality of work that eventually brings about fundamental change to the landscape. Not cosmetic change, fundamental change. We sincerely believe that we, at this moment in history, we can push for the Cuban medical personnel to come here. And one of the other things we didn't get a chance to get into, what's the long-term impact of them being here? It's not just about, because we're talking about non-communicable diseases, but not only that, because of Cuba's, many people feel Cuba's going to be the country that finds a cure to cancer. And for those of you who pass by cemeteries all day, on a regular basis, where many of those tombstones where we are represented, people under 6 feet under, they're there because of prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer. This is the benefit of this. For those of you who are watching during real life LEGO, commonly referred to as gentrification, but we're going to call it exactly what it is, where they will turn the senior citizens home to a Java Juice or a Planet Fitness. So treating the elderly is no longer a priority for this country. Cuba has the best gerontology program in the Americas. They have the lowest HIV AIDS rate in the world. We know the battles we have with that in our community. That's the benefit of sending our babies to go there for medical training. So this is, there's a short-term aspect to this. There's a long-term aspect to this. There's an African component to this. There's a Caribbean component to this. But because we're focusing on a pandemic that's in, that where the United States is the face of this pandemic, the same way they're the surveillance capital of the world, the same way that they're the war capital of the world, the same way they're the greed capital of the world, they're the COVID capital of the world right now. And a country whose guts that the government hates, not the people, who are at the mercy of this government, this is the clash we've been waiting for. Let's fight. Let's win. Thank you so much for the time you gave us tonight.
Listen, before you go, the because I know you got a lot of connections with the Organization of African Doctors. If you any of their representatives are able to talk later on or next month,
we'll see what we can do about that. We'll see what we can do about that. No question about it. I mean, we but at this time, you know, they're working.
I know it. Yeah.
They're working, man. They're working like 80-hour weeks. Good. The ones that were here, you know, like they're, you know, we, the one we know in Grady Memorial in Atlanta doing 30-year residency, he's working 82-hour, 83-hour weeks, the head resident of the COVID response team. Okay. So all over the country, they're strategically placed, I mean, and they are really, 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 really working. And, you know, we just want to continue to support them, and we just want to create an atmosphere where our young people will stand up and say that they're pushing for this. And of course, the established veterans, impeccable fighters that we have that are part of this fight, we're glad to have them shoulder to shoulder with us for this. But the fact that this has really resonated with our babies, that's what we feel so good about. And, you know, and people who have kept their distance for whatever sets of reasons are calling and reaching out and just asking what they can do. So, you know, well, that's the one thing about consistency. Those who avoid you yesterday embrace you today.
Good.
So we'll just keep fighting as we continue to bridge that gap. And rumor has it that you helped record a very significant conference call last week with some concerned fighters. And the MC of that event, that phone call, interviewed us last week. And we already know, Brother Elliot, that you have been circulating this to some of them, who you feel, based on their fervor, remind you of us. So hopefully we can close ranks with them, and they can, as they were seeking a solution, we think that what we offer tonight would be music to their ears. We haven't had a chance to talk to them yet, but we look forward to that. So the possibility, so the potential of the engaged, the quality of the engagement we've been having for the last 3 weeks, we've had more engagement with people in the last month than we've had in the last year. So that's just a testament to our people willing to find a solution. And we want to continue to build on this. But it's not for symbolic purposes. It's not for sentimental purposes. It's to win this fight that we're waging. So Pompeo can run, flap his gums all he wants. Trump can flap his gums all he wants. Mike Pence can flap his gums all he wants. All that's going to do is make us work harder. And we love to work, too. So it is what it is.
Brother Obi, the door is open. So anytime, any updates or anything of that nature, just give me a holler and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Richard. And I hope, you know, the listeners that we weren't able to talk to feel the same way that the listeners who called in and were overflowing with their compliments and encouragement. And it was so humbling that I didn't do what I normally do. Would have been trying to get them to do some work. We're just taking it all in right now. And because you need two things when you embrace an undertaking of this magnitude. You need work. You need people willing to labor. But the support and the encouragement is very important. And we must humble ourselves to that support and encouragement and never think that we have the luxury of dismissing it. We don't want to send our people the message ever that we're not appreciative. So we're very appreciative of it. It gives us a boost, and we're going to keep working and we're going to keep fighting. People can go to, once again, they can go to getoutcubaway.com. And thank you to so many people in Philadelphia. Dr. Malefi Asante stood with us on this. Omawali Africa, our younger brother, he's the one who contacted Ama Mazana, Dr. Mazana, when she was out of the country,
okay,
to make sure that they were signed up to this. Shout out to Empress Chi for getting Mumia on this. Shout out to Russell Schultz for getting his dad and Dr. Mark Lamont Hill on this. Shout out to you, Brother Elliot, for all the distribution. You did like 3 cycles of distribution of this. So we definitely appreciate that. And that represents true partnership, and that represents true respect.
Yeah.
And the respect you have for us, we have more for you.
And
believe that.
And Brother Richard was, he jumped in there too. Yeah, Richard was involved. Probably more than me.
Yeah.
Brother Obi, listen, we'll talk soon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
All right. Peace.
All right. Take care now.
Richard.
So,
you know, I'm glad he kind of laid it all out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when he talked about some of the folks that are involved, I really focused in on the elected officials or people close to politics that he talked about, because they're the ones that can, or that we should really hold responsible, put it that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because some of the other activists that he talked about, they're already working. And you can see, if you go to their particular cities, you can see their track record. You can see what they're doing. But some of these other folks, it's been lip service. That memorandum of understanding between the Black Caucus, the CBC, and Cuba at that time, to start funneling black young people to be educated as doctors and had room for 500. 500, Richard.
Mm.
And to date, as of that article in 2017, only 170 had been educated. I mean, who dropped the ball? Who's responsible for that? And do the public even really know? Now, just like Obi was saying, it had been circulated that Cuba was doing this and offering this.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody was interested, how could they really find out? I mean, they really had to be dedicated and get tied in with people who, or maybe mm-hmm. some activists like Brother Obi or some others. But they were supposed to get this information from their elected officials.
Hmm.
But that's who the memorandum of understanding was with. It wasn't with the John Q. public or the John Q. Black representatives of these communities. It was with the leadership. It goes back to what you've been talking about, Richard. This memorandum of understanding was with the leadership.
Which we have to, when Brother Obi said about, creating as far as young people, even these doctors, we have to create a new crop that
yeah.
this is a part of, and that's, and.
Now let's see what happens because he mentioned Chokwe Anton Lumumba.
Oh, yeah.
Said that he was going to put this to the Council of Mayors, mm-hmm. of black mayors.
Mm-hmm.
See, so now we got people that we can really start holding, and I'm not talking about Chokwe Anton Lumumba because he's been working, and he come from an organization that put him out there, that the Southern Cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
But when he puts it to the other Council of Black Mayors, then you got other people that's going to be involved. So he can come back with the report because he signed his name, and I'm just mentioning him.
Right.
He was one of the names that signed on in support. So they have to report back. Because if I make a commitment, I'm going to talk to so-and-so. When they reach out to me, I got to make the report back. I talked to Richard, I talked to whoever, and they didn't give me a response. They said no, whatever. So now we got an accountability that we can start mm-hmm. holding these people accountable. And believe me, knowing Obi, if these people start coming out with some wrong tones, and I'm talking about some of these other people, I'm not talking about the signers ons, I'm talking about some mm-hmm. of the other people, then he's going to put them out there.
Right.
And deservedly so. Because this is a pandemic that's really affecting our communities hard.
And it also requires the continuous understanding of defining and clarifying new leadership that is closer to the people so that they can be able to advocate for the doctors. Like once people kind of say, it's one thing when you're saying advocating for them to be a part of institutions. It's another thing when we're saying we want institutions created within our community.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't have to go to a hospital that you're telling us now don't have enough beds if all of us got sick, or don't have enough ventilators, don't have enough doctors, don't have enough nurses. We want to be able to, and that we don't need to go, and he was given the numbers as far as just the amount of people that was projected. Now, if I remember him saying, this was 10 years ago that 50 million people were, he said that was supposed to be projected to be able to pass based off of these health indicators,
mm-hmm.
which, obesity, high blood pressure, which this pandemic is showing that it's taking us out on those health indicators.
Yeah.
We want institutions that's close within our proximity. So that young people can be able to go to it on a regular basis, so that elderly don't have to go far, so that people who these doctors that'll be trained, who once we can make this number of 500 a year, they'll be living within the community that they're serving, so they'll know the health conditions of the people that's within that community. It whether you call it socialism or not, it becomes, this is what we need in order to put in check the health disparities that exist within our community. But all, more importantly, as he's saying, this is what we need to be able to inspire other younger people to get in the profession of being healers or medical supports right there where we are. That's not just, and it has to be done by having a policy, giving direction, and as you say, holding the political representatives responsible to distribute the resources within our community to build these kind of institutions.
Yeah, exactly. That drive should be there to become a doctor, especially right. When you got avenues there where you don't have to pay a dime. Mm-hmm. Just dedicate yourself to your community where you were from once you graduate.
And
instead of your children striving to be a football player, a basketball right. player, there's only a small percentage. And you didn't. A lot of times they go into these colleges and not really educating. They're not leaving with any degree. Their whole focus was there to participate in some type of sporting event for Europeans. To treat them like $40 million slaves, like the brother wrote that book, Bill mm-hmm. Roden.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we have, I mean, even though the structure isn't made to, but we have community development corporations already within our community. Why don't they have a public health component as a part of their organization? That's neighborhood based.
I know it.
Why don't they are and tied to the school system, being able to identify candidates that could be able to utilize the program and push the council persons or the state legislators to be able to say, here is somebody who we see just like it was that has the background to go to Cuba to be trained and make that commitment to come back and work within the community that they can come out of. That's not far-fetched, but we have to, within the community, not just, as you say, have the people, look, we have to have the community saying, this is the mindset of the agenda, the policy, and this is the directive that we're giving ourselves and anyone who wants this leadership position. And that is from a street, was that the block captain, the committee person, the council person, mayor, state legislator, state senator, congressperson, and all these here little things in between. That's just using the political machinery that exists, but that requires the will of us.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And in situations like this, like Brother Marcus that calls out of Tennessee, he was saying this long, it was almost his mantra long before this pandemic started, that, what does he say, Richard? Circumstances, conditions. Conditions mm-hmm. going to drive our people together.
Mm-hmm.
Brother Obi was talking about on the continent, in the islands, and here. The conditions is driving our people together. It ain't driving mm-hmm. you towards this man. He don't want nothing to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be the last on the list as far as he's concerned, with protective equipment, with ventilators, with doctors, with everything else. You think you're going to move up on the list? If we've been last on the list of anything, jobs, or business opportunities, mm-hmm. all this other stuff, you think when these things start that you're going to get some type of preference?
And Elliot, I'm saying, because we don't have no jobs, because we are under stress, because we don't know where we're going to live, because we don't have the food that is healthy for us in order to be able to just provide the nutrients for our bodies and our babies. That is a public health crisis. That's whether we have a virus or not. And we've been living with that in our generation for 50 years. 55 years to be exact.
Boy, I'm telling you.
You know what I mean? So I mean, you know, and that's what, you know, we got to make sure that those of us on the ground understand that this, and we got to think differently. We, as you know, Brother Obi, you know, he as a person, he's a testament of the kind of energy that we have to demonstrate in order to be able to organize. And you know, Ellie, it was interesting to me that he said in the last month, isn't it interesting? Now, he said more response has been in the last month than in the last year.
Yeah, I mean, and you know why, Richard? You know why?
Because our black behind's been sitting in the house with nothing to do but thinking and seeing people right around. We in the house and seeing a person being taken out the house and never coming back.
I mean, it's a blessing to people that haven't been directly affected, but a lot of our people have been directly affected by this, and two or three members of their families, some of them. This is real. Go ahead. Finish your point.
That's so, you know, and then to hear there's people who wants to provide us medical support and the political machinery is going to give us some State Department, national security, outdated Cold War thinking. And we supposed to just fall for it, which means that we're supposed to just die because you got a gripe.
Yeah, well, that's how a colony reacts, Richard. Just like you've been saying, that's how a colony reacts when you're told, "Well, you ain't gonna deal with them," and you say, "Yes, sir." What? Yes, master. Isn't that what Khalid Muhammad said in that collage?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a slave. You're a slave, and unless you admit that you're a slave, you'll never be free. That's what he says, Richard.
And this is not an individual effort. You know, that's why I asked, do you see synergy? Because all these people now, they have to be able to come together around, you know, because we right now raising the question, 50 years from now, do we want this to happen again? And they're telling us, shoot, by November.
It can happen again. Yeah. A lot of the experts been saying that this is not going to be over until they come up with some type of vaccine or whatever, until they run its course. I'm no medical official, but we're going to be going through this.
And they're collecting the data, making money off of it, building the vaccines, making money, going to basically require every child to be vaccinated, every person. They could, right now, they're saying, you know, I just seen the governor or the mayor, if you caught outside, what, $300, $500 fine?
I think in some areas it's $1,000, yeah.
If you don't have a mask on. So what happens when they get the vaccine? You're going to have one. And what that means in relationship to, they're saying now, I mean, it's a whole thing, but where are we in this picture other than being the ones who are just that are going to be consuming this? How do we live off of this?
Richard, I want you to look at this scenario. You got a country that's been squeezed by the United States for over 50 years, literally squeezed. And I'm talking about the people.
Mm-hmm.
The people on the street is really affected. So they developed all their energies to developing state-of-the-art medical research and doctors from their country to the point now where they're wanted all over the world. I think I read a published report that 141 countries around the world have asked for their doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And that country, instead of telling the United States, give them their behind to kiss, they're telling them, well, we'll help you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more that they're directing the "We'll help you" to us, not necessarily to them. That's my personal opinion.
Right.
But the thing is, they're saying, "We'll help you." Look at that mentality when you're dealing with Europeans. They don't want that pride. See, that's what's going to cause this country to fall. This system is falling, whether people realize it or not. Some people feel as though, listen, and some of our people feel as though this system is always going to be around, and I'm always be an American.
Mm-hmm. You know,
but these systems come and they go ahead.
It sparked the thought, you know, when you mentioned about how is it that a island starved for food, not being able to export too much of a natural resource, and they sat down at the table and said, "What are we going to do?"
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that, Richard. This is not happenstance. This was a policy that they said, "We're going to do this." And I'm quite sure they probably had some folks in the room that developed this policy that probably didn't agree with it.
Right.
They might want to do something else.
Right.
Or feel as though their country should focus in on something else. But evidently, the ideal of focusing in on developing state-of-the-art doctors and state-of-the-art medical training won out. And look what it has done 21 years later.
And you know what the common denominator, and somebody told me I have to shift the language, but, you know, and as you're bringing this up, and I'm hoping that the Time for Awakening listening audience is really paying attention to what we're saying, that we have to have a strategy, that we have to have a plan, that to be a colony is not to use, even if you don't believe we're a colony, let's use that as a frame of analysis for our strategic vision. What they said is that the model of Cuba is saying, well, it ain't, yes, it's, we only have so much land and we don't have so much dollars, but what we're going to focus on is building the Cuban people. And what does that require? Well, the Cuban people have to be educated. They have to have a high literacy rate. You can't be a doctor with a low literacy rate. They have to be healthy. You can't become a doctor. You can't create a medical infrastructure with sick people. Right? Yep. So obviously their strategic plan was to build their people. And now, 50 years later, and with the strategic plan, they put the infrastructure, the medical structure, call it socialism or whatever, the medical infrastructure is that the doctors and the nurses, they are right there in the community with people. First line of defense. Older people, younger people, prenatal care, senior citizen care, medical care. So they ain't got to go far away. And those doctors, well, if you got something that's that seems a little serious, you go a step up to another series of specialists. But the people close already understand because they have a direct relationship with the community of their health, their emotional health, their physical health, their educational health. So they ain't wait until they get to the point where the disease has manifested and now they got to figure out what we're going to do with it. They've caught it because they understood the people right before it even started. And it ain't about, did you take your medication? What happened in your house today? You know, did grandma fall, you know, or does she seems a little off? He said that they will be able to, that the world's, and this is scientific community, see that Cuba may be on the verge of coming up with the cure for cancer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, anybody that's concerned about humanity would be happy and get behind that. But the mentality of these Europeans that run this country is a hatred. Oh, I don't want to see them come up with it. I want to come up with it because I can make billions of dollars from this. We got to realize the mentality we dealing with. Richard, this goes straight to thought patterns and mindsets that we have to throw off. We have to throw off this man's mindset that we have developed over the centuries that we've been exposed to him here. This is a poison. This is a poison to our, it's poison to our people.
And he sound like, I'm thinking of, a man from Chicago. When you asked the brother from Chicago, Fred Hampton Jr.
Okay.
How do we determine whether somebody is not working in our best interest?
He said,
when we see they ain't working.
He said, we keep them busy. That's what he said. Right? He said, when they ain't working, they expose themselves.
Now, what is Brother Obi is saying the same thing?
Yeah, I know it. I know it.
Right?
I know it. And Richard, all the people that we've had on over the years, when the chairman said that, that was the best answer that I've ever heard. And listen, he knows firsthand what these people are going to do. His father was murdered by these people. He was in the bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a miracle that he wasn't killed.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's so important, again, because what we're emphasizing, you know, power, if we want power, real power, we want political power. It ain't just the part of just saying, well, who we voting for? Political power is about, do we have a strategic vision? Have we critically thought through what is our strengths, our weaknesses? Who is our opposition? What is the threat? And what can we do? Now, we definitely need to be raising our literacy rate in our community. I mean, this here pandemic is showing that.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely need to be raising our health condition within our community. This is showing that. We definitely need to be able to train people who look out for our best interests.
And should we as a people be reaching out to people that can help us with this? Exactly. If you got a society that have turned this around, they established that program, Richard, in those schools in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
It's 21 years later. And the world is clamoring for them and have been. This is not, they haven't been clamoring for them because of this COVID-19. They've been doing it over the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
With Ebola, with some of the other pandemics that haven't nailed this country, but it has affected other countries in the world. They've been clamoring for those doctors. Look at what they have done in 21 years. And when we talk about our situation, oh, it won't be done in our lifetime. It might be 200 years. You know, we got all types of woe is me type of talk. This can be done, and it don't have to take that long.
And nothing is, you know, I don't want anybody to believe that we believe anything is picture perfect. You know, we ain't talking about creating no utopia. We ain't talking about our lives will be no utopia. As a group, we're trying to project that our lives will be different than what it is now, different towards the better.
And Richard, just imagine, and I'm not talking about 1900 and the things that happened with our ancestors then. I'm talking about 20 years ago. When the memorandum, let's go back and let's slow walk this, Richard. They decide, Cuba decides as a nation, and we know that Cuba, they have a population of Hispanic there, and a lot of them is dark, but they also have a population of our ancestors that went there and that have became servants or in servitude. It's a large population of them. So you've got a country that established that they're going to do this. Now, they didn't say, well, let's establish it among ourselves and a 50-year plan. Maybe 50 years we'll go out and help other people. Richard, before they even got this thing off the ground, they come and meet with the CBC. That program was only 1 year old. And they said, listen, send people here from your community. They met with the CBC. They didn't meet with the Tea Party. Well, they didn't exist at the time. But they didn't meet with the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. by and large, mm-hmm. or the Republicans, or other white groups, or what's the name of that Jewish...
ADL.
They didn't meet with them. They came and met with the CBC and said, send your constituents here at least 500 a year. If we had done that or had leadership that was interested in doing that and really helping the community, how would that have transformed our communities, Richard, as a whole, with 500 doctors a year being infused into these communities?
But see, you know, Elliot, and this gets into this laziness, right? Because when we, as you say, when we backtrack, if they said, well, we got to produce 500 a year, then we got to look at our high school. You know, we got to look at the colleges. So here in Pennsylvania, we look at the black colleges like Lincoln and Cheney, right? And you say, well, can they produce the quality output to be able to select from those institutions? A number, and then we look back. Well, what's the feeder to them? Don't they come out of the high schools?
Yeah, but wait a minute. Then if you realize, if you sit down just like they sat down and say, well, wait a minute, right now we don't have that infrastructure set up, then it behooves you to set it up.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. Because then, you know, because they boasting now about early childhood education, right? But they ain't saying where it's supposed to go. You know, they're not, and I don't know if when they saying creating these schools, these, you know, producing these here daycare centers and, you know, and whatever, are they just holding pens? Do they really expect the educational output because they can't even figure it out?
And they don't want to figure it out, especially when it comes to our children. They don't want to figure it out.
So therefore, and this, you know, I apologize to the Time for Awakening audience.
Well, wait a minute, hold it, Richard. But I don't want to. They figured it out. It's not they don't want to figure it out because they're building new prisons all the time, and they're basing it off those poor test scores.
Right.
So they figured it out. What we gonna do?
That's where I'm going, Elliot, and I'm continuously pushing that button because if you know that that's where they're going, then when you talk about holding people accountable, even if you can't do it, then you got to be looking at side eye. Well, dang, I still might not have got out of junior high school, but I know you telling me they building that prison for my child who just in the third grade. You telling me that. you know, so I got to look at you side eye, but more importantly, I got to look at my neighbor. My nephew, my sister, we got to look at each other side eye. Like, are we really? Now, we sitting in the house right now, locked down. Well, what's the difference to this being a big prison right now? And you see what white folks are saying.
You see
what white folks are saying. Whether they the business white folks or the working white folks or the Yahoo white folks. They saying with they guns some, with they bikinis other, I ain't sitting in no house. You ain't locking me down.
And I'm going to do what I want to do. And I know you've seen some of the early figures, Richard, that have come out since they, because some of these states open up things before these 21 states that did it a couple days ago. And the cases have surged.
Surged, right.
It has surged.
And ain't nobody in our language saying, what was that thing that people were saying initially amongst black people that, you know, oh man, I can't think of it, Elliot. You know, like they basically they don't want to listen, you know. Ain't nobody saying these white folks don't want to listen. You know what I mean? You know,
they're not criticizing.
Ignorant. It was another term.
What, apathy or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, but I can't remember what it was, but.
But they don't want to criticize them at all for what they're doing. You don't hear any criticism about what they're doing. In fact, you hear encouragement from some elected officials, including this president. Oh, they only exercise. Now, wait a minute. This guy Wolf is not a Republican in Pennsylvania. He's a Democrat. But he talked the other day. I thought I was listening to Trump when he said, well, the people that was at, they're only exercising their constitutional right. That's what Trump said.
He better say that.
Oh, I'm not. Listen, I'm not saying that each, you know, but I'm just saying.
Were they at his door with a rifle?
Yeah, they was at. Yeah, they was at the law. Yeah, the Capitol. I don't think they was at his personal door.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah, but I'm just saying what they're saying. That's what they feel about what their brethren are doing. But why don't you get a group together and get your guns and go to the Capitol and see what they say about you? If you're an American, any of our listening audience, if you're an American, you watch your fellow Americans, because all these commercials is going on now, Richard. You see all these commercials on the television. Well, you don't have one. We're all in this together. That's the theme now that they're using. Well, if that's the case, black groups, inner city folks in the neighborhood, you live in the suburbs or whatever, get a group of your fellows together and go to your nation's capital, to your city hall with guns and say, we want to get back to work and see what happens.
You get out the block. If you get out the block.
Well, these people not only got out of their blocks, Richard, they got to the Capitol steps.
They were on the highway. You know what I mean? I mean, with AK-47s. And nobody stopped them.
Oh, man. And they screaming. I mean, they were within inches of these troopers' faces. Screaming. The troopers had masks on, but I know they still got a face full of spit.
And I seen a picture in New York. The ones who were on the beach, they passing out masks. But that aside, because we can focus on, we know what they'll allow them to do. What we need to be able to figure out is what is it we're going to do? Because we're looking at death and destruction in the immediate now and in the foreseeable future, because we are not looking at this public health situation as something that we need to address with urgency. And we need to be calling in people who have the kind of technical understanding to assist us to develop a strategy and a policy and an agenda to hold people accountable and develop them so that they know when they go in there fighting that we standing right there silently, not dealing with something else, ready to take their back. Because right now, they obviously getting, as that TV showed, they getting away with murder.
Well, listen, Obi told the listening audience that this directive is out there, this call, this appeal, and he mentioned some of the people that have gotten behind it, and some of them are politicians. So what we can do, we can work on two fronts. We can work to get some of these people out of there, because we've had people on this program that have independent parties in your areas that are already functioning. If they're not in your areas, you can start one and just latch on to those men to find out how to do it. We need to get these people from in front of us. But we can still work on two fronts, because we can confront the people that are in office now and demand that they sign this appeal or get behind it. If you don't know about it, we'll send it to you. In fact, they should be telling you about it. They're your leader. You shouldn't have to tell them anything. Leaders are supposed to come to you with, well, this is our plan or strategy. This is what's going on. Because the average folks, they don't know too many things about what's going on necessarily. That's why they elect you as a leader. You're supposed to come to them with the information. Call these people. Demand they sign this appeal. Because you're the your loved one will end up going to the hospital. And once he gets in there, you can't go visit him. You don't know whether he's on a respirator, a ventilator. He probably don't have one. He's just suffering in his room, and the next thing you know, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you never get a chance to see him once he leaves. It's not like you going up there to visit nobody in those hospitals. It's not like that. And especially in those wards.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't do something, right now it's not affecting me or you or some maybe some of our listening audience directly. And some of it, it has. But eventually it's going to knock on your door, on my door. What are we going to do? We're looking at our children. What are we going to do? Richard, I feel blessed, man, to know these people, to have them on this program, and dispense information to the listening audience. We could very well be talking foolishness every day, like those talking heads they have on these terrestrial shows, with all kind of stupid giggling and laughing every morning. I don't mind a little joke here and there, but 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, you thinking up all types of Amos and Andy satires and laughing and joking and all this type of stuff's going on. It ain't that much funny in the world. And especially now, you need serious discussions. This, these two representatives out of New York wrote an open letter to the Black Caucus, and I didn't get a chance to read it on the air. But at the end of the letter, Richard, they're demanding that they have four things that they demanded, because they put all this evidence forth about what's going on in Cuba and Venezuela and wanted the Black Caucus to respond to it based on violations of international law that the United States did in reference to those two countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they have it laid out, man. I'm going to send you this letter so you can read it.
Yeah, I can see that.
Well, at the end, they have demands here that they wanted the caucus to address. It says, raise your voices in unity. The first one, it says, raise your voices in unity with organizations and activists opposing Trump's administration's effort to topple existing Venezuelan government led by Nicolas Maduro by unlawfully, illegally, and militarily intervening in Venezuela to halt its established tactics and actions. Raise your voices in unity with organizations and activists working to end now the 60-year-old Cuban embargo and normalize relations with Cuba. Hold town hall meetings to discuss these issues raised in this letter to your constituents. Send a CBC fact-finding delegation to both Venezuela and Cuba to look into the issues raised in this letter, in this appeal. We look forward to learning and hearing from you. Excuse me. We look forward to hearing from you. Our contact information, and they left all the information there.
Mm.
But those four things, and the third and fourth, is really interesting to me. Hold town hall meetings to discuss these issues.
That's I'm calling people assemblies.
Mm.
And that, I mean, and it has to be structured that is permanent.
Yeah,
we constantly have to be coming together. Now, we can either use the technology to do it, like last week. You know, they had it basically was a town hall meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or we can do it physically, but we need to because you can't develop an understanding. You can't develop a strategy or an understanding of the strategy. You can't develop get agreement on a policy and an agenda and then look to who's advocating for it. And you have to be clear your history. You can't do that just no one session and no moment of crisis. We have to constantly do that, you know, and we can't be distracted or dissuaded that, well, you don't know enough, or I know too much, or
you ain't going to be able to do this. Yeah.
Yeah, I know it. I know what you're saying.
You know, it just, you know, but I'm glad that, you know, because these guys is getting serious. They've always been serious. They're in transition. You know, American foreign policy, American domestic policy, American infrastructure, Western political, economic, financial arrangement is changing. It's just, you know, they call it the fourth industrial revolution, and the Europeans call it the fifth industrial revolution. It's changing. And the question is, what, we just supposed to wait for the change to see where we're going to fall at? And we can't look at it from our point. Well, some of us, in a couple of years, we out of here. So yep. We got to look at it from a generational perspective.
We have to. Because you know where we're going to fall at. You see the way things are now and where we're at.
Right.
So when they restructure things, or what they hope to restructure, because if things keep going the way they are, you're going to see a total collapse of a lot of these systems that we see now. And he knows it. That's why he's so desperate for the country to get back to work.
And they're going to feed us anything.
We got to make some decisions, Richard, as a people.
Yeah.
Before we leave tonight, I just want to kind of go over the lineup here on Time for an Awakening. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshi from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Always interesting dialogue and conversations on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Again, that's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Right after this program, Black People's Matrix, with Brother Franklin Jones from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Time for an Awakening Media. That's on Mondays and Wednesdays. On Monday evenings, 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. And the first and third Monday of every month, Conversation, Reparation, and COVID's program from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. And they kind of double back on Saturday with Black Reality Think Tank Part 2 with the sisters that kind of run things, facilitate the show. And that's on Saturdays from 4 to 6 on Time for an Awakening Media. Did you get to hear them this Saturday, Richard?
I couldn't get in. I couldn't.
I tried. Time for an Awakening Media that they'll be on Saturdays from 4 to 6. Mondays through Fridays from 10 to 12, Night Talk with Warren Ballantyne and his podcast. And then on Fridays from 8 to 10, Time for an Awakening is back. From 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. Again, I want to thank our guest this evening, Brother Obi Ekpona Jr., and the listening audience. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Right now they're
little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school.
Children, to save the children.